Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
As we speak, the U.S. Fed has just decided not to hike rates this time, but they're leaving the door wide open, aren't they?
Well, they're suggesting maybe one more still before the end of the year. I think coming into 2024 in an election year, they're in a very sticky spot. So they may indeed try and hike one more time, but I think that that will certainly be the end of this. The data of late has been universally bad. Retail sales is falling, you know, mortgage applications, everything's at sort of 20-year lows. I think that that's going to be a concern and a big problem in an election year, as I say. The other issue, of course, is they don't want inflation to come roaring back because that's also politically unpalatable. At the current statement, they're saying we're going to leave rates around 5.5 and then possibly have a couple of cuts in the second half of 2024. So a couple of cuts is less than the market has been hoping for. So that'll be a disappointment if that's all that actually manifests. But the other major headwind right now, of course, is we've got oil prices spiking because OPEC or Saudis and Russians have agreed to cut rates and to cut output and hold it at a lower level for longer. So that is really causing a shock to supply at a time when we are seeing demand start to roll over because global demand is weakening in all consumption-based economies. But it is a concern with respect to the way that the oil price has been elevated in the last little while. You've got U.S. gas prices over $4 a barrel $4 a gallon nationally, and in Canada they're high as well. So we know that the consumer's on the ropes with the high mortgage rates that have relatively high mortgage rates that they've been dealing with of late. And when you get that combination, so you know, higher mortgage rates, the highest since 2007, actually drove 25% of the year-over-year increase in the Canadian CPI in the latest data. So higher mortgage costs are bleeding through to higher cost of living at a time when you've got these oil cuts in terms of output putting pressure on price and gas, and that's really a concoction for misery in the household sector. And we're starting to see that play out all across the board, whether and not just in Canada or America, but certainly in the UK, certainly in China. We're seeing exports drop from China, imports and exports down significantly. Even Japan, who's been on a bit of a winning streak in the last year, has seen a big decline in its exports of late. You know, we've already got Germany in a recession. The producer prices in August were down more than 12% year over year in Germany. That's almost unprecedented. And we've got the ECB that, you know, recently hiked 25 more beeps to 4%, all while lowering their economic outlook for 23 to just 0.7% and to 2024 to just 1% if they're lucky. So they're saying, well, we think we've hiked enough, but, you know, that they've still been hiking into an inverted yield, into a very weak economy, and they're saying they don't see much strengthening over the, you know, next 18 months. So the euro, of course, fell to a six-month low. And here's the other part of this puzzle, Jim, is the U.S. dollar. So we've got the higher oil shock, price shock, that's hitting consumption and discretionary income in terms of what's available for everything else after they cover their fuel costs. We've got the higher mortgage rates being a big shock to the system. And then you've also got the U.S. dollar, which has been rising. It's up 11% since the Canadian dollar since May of 2021, but it's higher against its benchmark. It was the basket of currencies, the DXY, was recently around 105 again. And this really puts a lot of pressure on, first of all, S&P company revenues, because 40% of S&P 500 companies generate more than half of their revenue from international sales. So when you get a strong U.S. dollar, that is suggesting negative impact on earnings per share. So that's relevant, of course, to the stock market. Also, you get this a major debt service increase. Not only have rates gone up so much, but for U.S. In debtors, which is, there's a lot of international debt denominated in U.S. dollars. So for those who are paying back in U.S. dollars, when you see the increase in the currency itself, it also makes the cost of carry that much more expensive. So you're really getting these three major things. So despite the fact that, you know, the inflationary rate has come down sharply, and I think it will continue to do so over the next year, in the interim, we've got these sort of price spikes in the, as I say, the cost of carry on housing, as well as on fuel, as well as on the U.S. dollar. This is really adding some insult to injury in terms of the pressure on the global economy.
Hmm. Now, the Bank of Canada stood firm the last time they could have hiked rates. Are they going to be in lockstep with the U.S. Fed? Maybe one or two more hikes and then reduce them next year?
Yeah, I don't think the Bank of Canada has the same a tolerance or in sense of urgency with regard to hiking again. I think that they may well stay on the sidelines here. As I said, the latest CPI data in Canada's trended up again, but a huge part of that is mortgage interest rates, right? The increased cost of housing that's coming from the dramatic leap in the cost of carry. So I think that that's a self-fulfilling doom loop, so to speak, and the Bank of Canada seems to be very aware of that. They, in their own September 8th report, Indicators of Financial Vulnerability, they wrote about the fact that 30% of mortgaged homes in Canada in the first quarter of the year of 2023 were actually purchased by investors, so to speak. So these are people buying either a secondary or third property, either, you know, for because they think it's a good place to put capital. You know, it's not a primary residence scenario. And 30% is up from like 20% before the pandemic, and even less than that, you know, in over the long-term average, you're looking at more like 10% is typically that cohort. So the fact that you've got a lot of investors, and there's this misunderstanding that if you're an investor, you're somehow doing it with cash. That's not the data. The data is that there's a lot of highly levered participants that have been buying, and that 30% of the Bank of Canada's number is 30% of mortgaged homes in Canada were purchased by people looking at them as a secondary, not a primary residence. So that just makes the market here that much more vulnerable. That plus the fact we don't have these long 30-year fixed-term mortgages like they do in the United States. Of course, in Canada, as you know, we had 30% of our mortgages were floating rate in the last couple of years, which meant that they were extremely vulnerable to the rate hiking cycle. As well as, you know, we have these fixed terms of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 these years. So every year we're certain to get a bunch of debt coming up for renewal. So the Bank of Canada's own assessment is that this presence of levered investors in this magnitude has definitely increased. It drove prices up through bidding wars and intensely inflated the prices during low rate environment. And now it also means that just not having rates go down for a while or just stay the same is a huge pressure. And you start to see investors bail. So they're not as sticky as primary home residents. They tend to start, you know, if they've got negative carry, which most of them did. In other words, it was costing them monthly, even if they were renting properties out because they had paid too much. And now with the higher rates, of course, there's a revelation that they really can't afford to keep or maintain these properties. And you're starting to see a jump in listings. So just at the same time that we're seeing, you know, a decline in the amount of people who can qualify to buy these properties, which is at, you know, 22-year lows, and there's been about a 35% decline in purchasing power just on the rate cycle that happened in the last 18 months. So, you know, the reality is that people can afford to pay much less than the going price for most properties, and that's leaving a gap. So you're getting listings on the rise, transactions at a very low level. I was just checking in with some of my solicitor friends who do, you know, real estate work primarily, and they were telling me that they're still relatively busy right now, but more so with refinancing. So this is people who are trying to consolidate. You know, maybe they have a car loan and a line of credit and, you know, a bunch of credit card debt, and they're looking, if they can, to consolidate in a new mortgage to try and streamline payments. But they're doing so, you know, by adding higher, like the mortgage rates, of course, higher than they were a couple of years ago. So there's a finite amount of that because, you know, there's only so much equity there that people can even access or do these refinancings with. So although there's still a good surge of that activity, the actual sales activity is very low right now in terms of deals going through. So all of that, you know, we've got bank lending contracting across all the world economies. The number of banks tightening their lending standards is the highest that we've seen since the past recessions, 2008 financial crisis and that sort of thing. And it's just likely to continue here as resales. There's been some life in new home properties. Builder issued brand new properties from builders because they can do things like pay down the rate, and they have been throwing in a bunch of incentives, you know, which don't necessarily bring down the price. They just add perks, so to speak. But even then, we're seeing the price of housing in the U.S. is off more than 12% from the peak, and in Canada, again, more than 11%. So I think these factors are going to weigh for a long time, even if central banks don't hike any further. Indeed, it'll be interesting to see how long their resolve lasts in 2024 as this economic data gets worse.
The real estate industry said only three cities saw increases in home prices: Vancouver, Calgary, and Hamilton. Well, there's a lot of nation out there where you're talking about prices going down already.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, obviously, wherever homes are less expensive, have appreciated less in the last few years, then there's a greater probability that a person with a sort of a average household income might be able to qualify to buy them. So certainly where prices are lower, that's advantageous. But in other cases, I think it's sort of just a couple of months of strength heading into the fall. And I think it'll be not long lasting by all accounts. So, and again, this is not something we're seeing just in Canada, right? This is happening in China in spades. I've been posting quite a bit about that because there was that loop of cash flowing from the Chinese economy and the Chinese housing bubble through into other countries, just like there was from Japan in the late 80s when that property bubble and equity bubble got so big and Japanese people were putting money abroad, and that was sort of infiltrating and spreading the impacts all around the world. And now as that capital flows back, because the Chinese property sector is in a state of extreme distress right now, and that is driving a liquidity crunch across that country and economy. And everyone, don't forget, was expecting the China reopening story to be one of the big pluses this year, right? They were looking at the second year of the Fed hiking cycle and saying, you know, oh, it, you know, consumers are under pressure, the discretionary income, discretionary spending is weak, and we're going to see a downturn in demand-led economies. But hopefully China, because it's been through a low patch with shutdowns during COVID, et cetera, hopefully that will reinvigorate demand. Well, in fact, that hasn't happened. China has continued to disappoint year to date, and so the pressures there are continuing to spread. And I think that they are not going to be the riding to the rescue the way many had hoped they would, both whether it be on the commodities front, because they've been the major consumer of commodities for the past, you know, many years. That's just not coming back. As I say, other than the recent jump in the price of oil based on, you know, artificial demand artificial supply constraints that are put on by the producers in particular, we're not seeing other commodity demand jump because we have this major downturn in the world manufacturing sector. So it'll be interesting to see how much of that flows through, but I'm certainly watching equities and the bond market extremely carefully. You know, bonds, treasury bonds in particular, are still off slightly in 2023. And if they close with a negative return in 2023, Jim, that will be the third year, consecutive year, that they have had a negative return on a total return basis. And that's the only time that's, never seen before since 1928. So if you're wanting to know, you know, where to place bets of mean reversion in 2024, you know, as we head into the fourth quarter, as we look into what is likely to bring opportunity in 2024, I would not say it's the housing market. I think we're still early stages in that downturn, and we have quite a bit more price compression to go there before numbers start to look attractive. I wouldn't say it's in the equity market, because although we've had some rebound in like large cap tech stocks in 2023, when you look at them, that's 34% of the S&P's broad index now is comprised of the 10 largest S&P companies, primarily in the tech space, and they have a price-to-earnings ratio of 50 times. That's the highest since 2001, which was also heading into a recession, and much higher than that 10 largest stocks got in the 2008, you know, stock mania. So we've got a massive 80% of the rebound year to date was driven by this handful of stocks. But you've got, you know, overvaluations across the board. The rest of things have been basically in a bear market that started in 2021. So they've been making some progress. You know, the S&P, even with this rally year to date, is back to where it was exactly 2 years ago. So it's gone nowhere since September of 21. It's still about 7% off its October 21 peak. The U.S. banks, which is very interesting, regional banks, of course, had the crisis in March, and we saw, you know, a big drop and then started to have a rebound. But U.S. banks are still 35% from their peak pricing in December of 21. They have not participated in this rebound with stocks since the first quarter of 2023. Real estate equities are off about 30%. The Russell 2000, which is the economically sensitive part of the stock market, is because it's smaller and more in tune with the economy, is off 25%. You know, we've got the TSX again, same level as July 2021 today, Jim. The financials are off significantly from their peak in February of 22. The miners are, you know, back where they were 3 years ago. I mean, so there's just this ongoing bear market, and I think we've made great progress in some areas and sectors, and I'm encouraged that that will continue for some time yet. But the S&P dividend yield today at 1.55 compared with a 10-year treasury yield of 4.36, that's the most negative reward prospect for stocks relative to bonds that we've seen since October of 2007. And that was another time when equities came into the fall really strong. You know, all the soft landing talk, all of the prospects, you know, talking about how the rate hiking wasn't going to crimp the economy that much. And what happened, of course, is that stocks went on to tank for the next couple of years, and bonds rallied sharply. And that's exactly what we've seen. This is the treasury, the government bond side, not the corporate debt side. I think the corporate debt side still has some significant downside. U.S. high-yield bonds, that's the junkiest grades of credit, are only yielding about 374 basis points over investment grade, the highest quality stuff. And typically at market bottoms, you see about an 800 or an 8% spread between the low-grade high-risk bonds and the most secure capital bonds. So we're, you know, we still have a lot of repricing to go on the debt side. As I say, if you have to make a bet on what's likely to surprise to the upside, I would say it's the treasury bond space, the government, the highest credit qualities, paper. Preferred shares are off about 28% from their peak. But I think they too have further to go, because unlike bonds with fixed maturity dates, most preferred shares today are floating rate. indefinite, perpetual. They don't have an actual date where they have to give you back the principal. And a lot of people got lured into these ETFs of prefs and things during the low rate environment, thinking they were getting some increased yield, but actually, you know, having lost nearly a third of their value, and again, having no maturity date, so there's no real guarantee there. And also, you know, many of the issues have, the issuer can skip the payment of the dividend, not have to pay it. They're not even necessarily cumulative. So there's been a lot of junky paper bought by people looking for income in the past few years that are paying a severe price here. But I do think that we're making good progress. The relative upside on stocks relative to the treasury market right now is just not attractive at all, but it will be. And I think in 2024, that may indeed be, you know, later in the year, once we get into the cutting cycle. As I've mentioned many times, you don't get an equity bottom typically until the Fed has been back to cutting rates and is nearly done. And by then, you're basically through the recession. And that's when you start to see things looking up again. So that's what I'm thinking we're entering in 2024.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, anything that had the words AI in it seemed to be hot properties earlier this year. Has the shine come off AI, and is it going to be the new dot-com bust of 2000?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hype got far ahead of the reality, and the applications, the uses that can actually expedite things or improve efficiency and productivity. I think it's definitely a theme that's going to be with us, a long-term secular development. But in terms of the pricing, you know, it got to be absolutely bonkers. Things like NVIDIA that were the poster child for all things AI have rolled over again. We're starting to see declines across the board. You know, Apple's come off the top of where it was. And things are starting to, I think, be more reflective of not just the higher for longer, which is bad for tech stocks, because, you know, if we take the central banks at their word that they may be done hiking here, but they're not likely, they don't expect to cut again soon, that's a not good news for the tech sector, because they depend on cheap financing to try and, they basically bring in capital to try and do their development and research, and they need to keep enticing investors. So if they have, you know, competition in the way of guaranteed returns in the 5% area for things like treasuries and money market and that sort of thing, that's a problem for the tech space. So I think that that's one of the issues. And the other issue is that it's price. They just got so lunatic in terms of the mania driving, how much people were paying, made no sense on an investment basis. So just as we saw at other peaks like in 2000, I think that the technology may indeed endure, and some companies will continue to be winners in the space, but that isn't necessarily reflective of how their share prices will do over the next year or two.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.